Iceland and Iran. Iranians to this day hold a grudge against both countries for their interference. And Brits and Americans just can't bear to let go of their seemingly loosening grip on this region. Not that the method has to make sense. Mr. Tabrizi is a historian we met at Ebrat Museum. The prison is a reminder of torture by Savak, the intelligence service, during the Shah's time. So I had to ask if an imperialist Britain and capitalist US could have had anything to do with physical torture.
Colonialism is colonialism. It's colonial in nature. The colonizers aren't enemies, they're friends. There might be some rivals between them, but that's as long as they want to dominate a region. If nations wake up, they will also unite. For example, during the constitutional revolution in Iran circa 1906, the nation won. But we see that in 1907, the Russian and British divided Iran among themselves. That's why they were both rivals. The Russians wanted to colonize Iran with their 1919 deal. If the deal had been implemented, the 1921 coup and ascension of Reza Khan to the throne would have not taken place, because Rusuvat Dole and the members of the Lodge of Awakening would have done that. But when the deal broke down, their objective switched to changing the government and its structure.
And so the plot and fight continues, as is hinted at in Gonjo. Britain appears to be complementing U.S. hostile actions against Iran and other countries in the region. For example, the United States has not fought in any war in the Middle East without Britain. The UK and US may be secret rivals, but they can't do without one another to hold on. Britain noticeably appears desperate to keep in with America since Brexit in 2020.
On the other hand, the Americans don't have the experience that the British do in Iran and the region, and they need a network of accurate geographical and ethnic information about Iran. They want to know about Iranians' habits and characteristics. They need to have relations with Iran's foreign opposition and other issues, which we mainly call soft power.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. This series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
The so-called wars of 9/11, 20 years later, don't appear to have met any ends, never mind fulfilling evidently false premises they were based on. Twin Towers and an Al-Qaeda explosion? To this day, no one knows for certain it wasn't an inside job. The British and American people have also had enough of these senseless wars. In 2015, YouGov revealed that support for West Asia or Middle East intervention had collapsed from two-thirds to one-third since 2003. A similar fall from 63% to 38% were recorded by YouGov America. By November 2019, the US had spent under $6.5 trillion on almost two decades of wars with more than 7,000 military dead. Britain had lost over 630. The justification was not satisfying. There's plenty more to relate from history and on current affairs, and we will return with what we've time for. But in the meantime, a quick media review indoors to see what other outlets have to say. it. Here's how the news words it. The Financial Tribune reads, collective efforts free from foreign meddling key to regional stability. President Ebrahim Raisi stressed the importance of solving issues in the region through dialogue, saying neighborly cooperation free from foreign interference is a prerequisite for regional stability and security. Cooperation and synergy among regional countries without foreign interference are prerequisites for regional stability and security, the establishment of peace in countries of the region and welfare of its nations, Raisi said in a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein in Tehran. Iran believes that dialogue among regional countries aimed at finding solutions to the existing problems and improving relations would promote security and stability, while foreign meddling in the region's affairs would increase tensions, he stressed. Tasnim News points to nuclear deal talks. Iran not to allow JCPOA talks to feature irrelevant issues. A high-ranking Iranian diplomat said Tehran would resolutely stand by its assertion that neither the JCPOA talks nor the nuclear deal are allowed to feature any irrelevant subject matter, such as Iran's defensive missile program or its regional influence. Kazem Alibabadi, Iran's permanent ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, made the remarks in an interview reflecting on a warning issued by leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei about the West's intention to use the 2015 nuclear deal to enable interference in the country's affairs. The U.S. left the agreement, which is officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in 2018. It then reimposed the inhumane sanctions that the deal had partially lifted and started forcing other countries into abiding by the coercive economic measures too. Its threesome European allies in the accord, the UK, France, and Germany, were quick to align themselves with Washington's new approach. In a move pointed out by the leader, they have been trying to advance a provision that could pave the way for their meddling in the Islamic Republic's affairs. And that would be it for this segment. Do stay tuned. If the Brits and Americans continue with hopeless wars because of an illusion of colonial grandeur from a time past, Iran is known as the world's first empire, a benevolent empire, 2,500 years ago. Yet it doesn't go capturing weaker countries because of some delusion of what can be.
Since Fath Ali Shah's rule, we have witnessed the betrayals, troublemaking, and crimes of the British in Iran. The British were to blame for one of the betrayals against Iran during the Iran-Russia war. They're the ones who separated Herat from Iran and deployed troops in Bushehr and committed crimes there.
Since after Iran's Islamic Revolution, the UK has always acted in hostile fashion. For example, in 1980, the country cut ties with Tehran, mostly due to the US embassy takeover in November 1979, and closure of that embassy at the request of Washington itself. The Den of Spies, as Iran named that embassy. An attack on the Iranian embassy in London won't have come as a total surprise. Soon after the US embassy, the UK closed its Tehran mission. Around the same time, the Iranian embassy in London was forcefully occupied by a group of six anti-Islamic Republic pan-Arabist gunmen. They identified themselves with the Democratic Revolutionary Front for the Liberation of Arabistan, DRFLA, which actually meant Iran's Khuzestan province of Persians and Arabs. It was perceived to be a Carter-Thatcher conspiracy executed by Iraqi hands.
This has been the usual MO of the British since World War II to support minorities in different countries to pressure the others. This leaves those regional countries in a perpetual state of weakness and tension. When the UK throws its weight behind a minority in some countries to get to power, for example in Bahrain, the minority needs backing to stay in power. This makes them dependent on London in the long run.
British influence, or Britain's pan-American influence, doesn't have to be direct. It has the UN to wield as its weapon, especially with America at its side. And so it can support and prop up all anti-Iranian plans and sanctions in the United Nations and likes.
In defining colonialism, we say it has had three stages. The first was the old colonialism, like the military occupation of India by the British government. The second is neo-colonialism, like bringing to power Reza Khan in Iran, Ataturk in Turkey, and Faisal in Iraq. In this type of colonialism, they actually bring in their own people. There is also a trans-colonialism that starts from international institutions, media, and universities. This is a type of colonialism the U.S. is at the forefront. It's the neo-colonists' move to fight back.
Another means of indirect meddling in Iranian affairs is supporting wannabe overthrowers of the Islamic Republic, sheltering separatists and monarchists. At the other end of the overthrowing spectrum, we've also got the MEK. Now, the MEK is a whole different story. Otherwise known as the hypocrites, they are heavily armed, and they're a cult-like terror group that fought alongside Iraq against Iran in the 1980s. Traitors, so to speak. And these groups don't just exist. They're voiced by anti-Iranian Persian language opposition news networks launched by or allowed to be launched by the UK in the UK. Iran International is one. It is owned by Volent Media that has a director named Adil Abdulkarim, who is a Saudi national and known to put Saudi funds behind the channel. Now, this channel began operating in 2017 when relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia were sore. BBC Persian TV, on the other hand, was launched in mid-January 2009, just months before the post-election riots in Iran. Could be just a coincidence. It's in the name of freedom of expression that the UK has become a safe haven for groups opposing the Islamic Republic. Hence, the launching of set channels and moving around money by Iranians of the opposition.
Since Britain created the BBC radio years ago, it's been gathering opponents of Iran and training them. I don't want to talk about conspiracy theories that I personally believe in, but the BBC is funded by the British government. The outlet claims to be working independently, but it receives funding from the government. The vast majority of its employees are like George Orwell, who was a spy and worked for the BBC. A majority of them have ties with intelligence services in West Asia and other regions of the world. Naturally, when London opposes a country, it will gather the opposition members and provides them with services.
It's no secret the UK has blocked Iran's access to its assets. It was reported in 2009 to have frozen $1.64 billion in Iranian assets, actually, under the EU and UN sanctions against Iran. The UN Security Council imposed three sets of sanctions on this country between 2006 and 2009 over its nuclear program. While Tehran said its program was designed only to generate electricity, I asked if withholding blocked Iranian money is the UK's own decision or if it is waiting for a green light from the USA before it releases the funds. A lot more money has safely crept into the UK from Iran, so the question holds.
Britain has had trade relations with Iran for years after the Islamic Revolution. It can claim that it can't return Iran's funds because we no longer have trade ties because of the sanctions. This claim isn't valid. The UK has had trade relations with Iran for decades, even after the Islamic Revolution. Also, after the JCPOA was signed, all sanctions were lifted in the first couple of years, giving the UK the chance to pay back what it owed, but it didn't.
UK intervention has, of course, not always been indirect. In fact, it has been physically hostile on occasion, as recently as just over 2 years ago. The UK illegally detained a tanker carrying Iranian oil in international waters, claiming it was transporting oil to Syria in violation of the EU sanctions. That was on July the 4th, 2019, years after the 2015 nuclear deal which it violated.
In 2019, Britain embarked on an adventure in the Mediterranean Sea. It seized an Iranian tanker that was carrying Iranian oil to West Asia. It was later revealed that this was done at the request of the United States. Iran could not get its oil tanker back through negotiations. This was while no international law allowed such a seizure. After a while, Iran demonstrated a strong reaction to this, forcing the UK to release the tanker. This shows the decline of Britain's hard power. It also indicated the US influence and issues related to ties between Iran and the UK.
British meddling here began 2 centuries ago. Whether it'll go on much longer is not known. To see where Anglo-Iranian relations will lead and hear all else that's to be known about Iran, tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Until then, bye.
Ravi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Ravi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ravi English Radio.
Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case when it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work, to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written jointly by Mandy Smith Berger and William Harting, authors. This article is published under the heading U.S. nearly $1.3 trillion national security budget isn't making Americans any safer. Stay tuned for more. President Biden's first Pentagon budget, released late last month, is staggering by any reasonable standard. At more than $750 billion for Defense Department and related work on nuclear weapons at the Department of Energy, it represents one of the highest levels of spending since the Second World War, far higher than the peaks of the Korean or Vietnam Wars or President Ronald Reagan's military buildup of the 1980s. And roughly 3 times what China spends on its military. Developments of the past year and a half, an ongoing pandemic, and intensifying mega drought, white supremacy activities, and racial and economic injustice among them should have underscored that the greatest threats to American lives are anything but military in nature. But no matter, the Biden administration has decided to double down on military spending as the primary pillar of what still passes for American security policy. And don't be fooled by that striking Pentagon budget figure either. This year's funding request suggests that the total national security budget will come closer to a breathtaking $1.3 trillion. mind-boggling figure underscores just how misguided Washington's current security award that should increasingly be put in quotation marks policies really are. No less concerning was the new administration's decision to go full speed ahead on long-standing Pentagon plans to build a new generation of nuclear-armed bombers, submarines, and missiles, including, of course, new nuclear warheads to go with them, at a cost of at least $1.7 trillion over the next 3 decades. In all, Biden's first budget is a major win for key players in the nuclear industrial complex, like Northrop Grumman, the prime contractor on the new nuclear bomber and a new intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, General Dynamics, the maker of the new ballistic missile submarine, Lockheed Martin, which produces sea-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, and firms like Honeywell that oversee the key elements in the Department of Energy's nuclear warhead complex. The Pentagon's proposed base budget, which in the past year has included routine spending for fighting ongoing conflicts, was $715 billion for the fiscal year 2022, $10 billion more than last year's request. Despite complaints to the contrary by advocates of even higher Pentagon spending, that represents no small addition. It's larger, for instance, than the entire budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. No question about it, the Pentagon remains by a long shot the agency with the largest discretionary budget. As for what's in the base budget, there are a number of particularly troubling proposed expenditures that warrant attention and congressional pushback. Spending on the Pentagon's new intercontinental ballistic missile, known formally as the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, has nearly doubled in the new proposal from $1.4 billion to $2.6 billion. This may seem like small change in such a budget, but it's just a down payment on a system that could, in the end, cost more than $100 billion to procure and another $164 billion to operate over its lifetime. More importantly, as former Secretary of Defense William Perry noted, ICBMs are some of the most dangerous weapons in the world because a president would have only a matter of minutes to decide whether to launch them upon a warning of an attack, greatly increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. In short, the new ICBM is not just costly, but exceedingly dangerous for the health of humanity. The Biden budget should have eliminated it, not provided more funding for it. Another eye-opener is the decision to spend more than $12 billion on the F-35 combat aircraft, a troubled, immensely expensive weapon system whose technical flaws suggest that it may never be fully ready for combat. Such knowledge should, of course, have resulted in a decision to at least pause production on the plane until testing is complete. House Armed Services Committee Chair Adam Smith has stated that he's tired of pouring money down the F-35 rat hole, while the Air Force's top officer, General Charles Brown, has compared it to a Ferrari that you don't drive to work every day, but only drive it out on Sundays. Consider that an embarrassing admission for a plane once publicized as a future low-cost bulwark for the U.S. combat aircraft fleet. Whether the Air Force, Navy, and Marines, the three services that utilize variants of F-35 will stay the course and buy more than 2,400 of these aircraft remains to be seen. Count on one thing, though. the F-35 lobby, including a special F-35 caucus in the House of Representatives, and the Machinist Union, whose workers build the planes, will fight tooth and nail to keep the program fully funded, regardless of whether or not it serves national security needs. And keep in mind that the F-35 is only one of the many legacies of failed Pentagon modernization efforts. Even if the Pentagon were to acquire its new systems without delays or cost overruns, something rare indeed, its expensive spending plans have already earned this decade the moniker of the terrible 20s. Worse yet, there is a distinct possibility that Congress will push that budget even higher in response to wish lists being circulated by each of the military services. Items on them that have yet to make it into the Biden Pentagon budget include things like, surprise, more F-35s. The Army's wish list even includes systems it claimed it needed to cut. That the services are even allowed to make such requests to Congress is symbolic of a breakdown in budgetary discipline of the highest order. The base budget also includes mandatory spending for items like military retirement. This year's request adds $12.8 billion to the Pentagon's tab. Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case. When it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work, to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Unfortunately, unlike the proposed Pentagon budget, significant Green New Deal-style infrastructure funding is far less likely to be passed by a bitterly divided Congress. Washington evidently doesn't care that such investments would also be significantly more effective job creators. Sadly, though, too many of America's political leaders have clearly drawn the wrong lessons from the pandemic. If this country continues to squander staggering sums on narrowly focused national security activities at a time when greatest challenges are anything but military nature, this country and the world will be a far less safe place in the future.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States is anything but united these days. Inside the country lies much discontent and a major divide. And outside the country, even Washington's allies are starting to say that the U.S. hegemony is waning rapidly, especially after the Afghanistan debacle. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the American Empire, or are we rapidly approaching its dissolution? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Ian in New York. Ian, do you think that the U.S. is waning? And if so, when do you think this actually started? Some say from 1971 when gold no longer backed the dollar. Others say since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what's your assessment of this overall?
It's very difficult to say. Oh, it's been waning almost the minute it was established, because people successfully stood against it. You could say that the Vietnamese victory against the U.S. was a clear signal, but it was definitely at its height after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and with the Iraq War. The U.S. was unchallenged internationally. Even its enemies didn't really dare go against it. That's been eroded totally. But what happened in Afghanistan was not significant in economic or military terms. It was significant in terms of prestige, which, as far as global diplomacy is concerned, is almost as important. But people are still going to think twice before they challenge the U.S. They still have hugely disproportionate armed forces. They still have hugely disproportionate financial support, less so than it was, and it's definitely waning. A lot less quickly than some of us would have hoped, perhaps, but it's also got rising, well, it's got rising rivals, in particular China. I don't really think that Russia is one of the major rivals. It's Russia is sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons. It doesn't have a massive economy, but it does have this residual armed forces and nuclear weapons. China is a rising power in every sense, and obviously the US is scared about it. But once again, the US isn't unrivaled there, and China can't really exploit the US's weakness, because one of the reasons why China has been rising is because it sells so much of its goods to the United States, and it borrows so much money from the United States, it lends so much money to the United States. So they're inextricably bound together. It's not a straight one-on-one superpower confrontation like Moscow and Washington in a, what you might say, the good, the bad old days, when they really didn't have that much to do with each other. There was almost minimal contact in culturally, financially, and other ways. But the United States is a victim of its own failures. Stay with me.
Let me. We're going to talk about the reasons for this, but let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Now, American political scientist Francis Fukuyama says that the truth of the matter is that the end of the American era had come much earlier. The long-term sources of American weakness and decline are more domestic than international. What do you think about that?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I think the decline of the U.S. forces started not when the U.S. was engaged in war, like in Lebanon 1982 or 1983, in Iraq in 2003, in Syria 2011. It is, what is the outcome of all these wars? Of course, the U.S. has the strongest military machine and military power, but what is the result of this machine? Winning the ground and then not be able to hold it. It's exactly the same as ISIS is able today to attack small villages and win and then withdraw. But the U.S. is able to stay for much longer, for many years, and then being kicked out and forced to withdraw. The moment the Americans sit with the Taliban and negotiate a peace deal is the moment of the decline and the defeat of the U.S. after 20 years. So there is no point for the U.S. to have so much the mighty military power when the result is very slim at the end of the day. So yes, it is a decline of the empire. It is the rising of other forces that not only are rival but also are defying the U.S. and challenging the U.S. Forces, even if they don't stand to the exact U.S. Military power. And they have a minor force, but however they can and they are able to defy the U.S. Like we've seen that in Iran, we've seen that in Syria, we've seen that in Lebanon, and we've seen that in Iraq, even a small group. And the Taliban managed to stand against the Americans and force the withdrawal. So yes, I think the U.S. Defense Secretary is quite right by saying it is just a big power, but it's big power not able to reach the end, achieve anything at the end of the day.
Okay, well, Ian, there have always been different opinions in the U.S., like most places, but it was magnified greatly during the Trump era. How divided do you actually think the country is currently?
It's extremely divided. I just want to add that the people who brought you the Iraq War were the people behind the project for the new American century. And they foresaw this precisely. In their own way, they were clear-sighted. They said America was declining economically, and so they had to cement in a military advantage now to ensure their hegemony over the next few years. And they're proved entirely right, apart from the fact of being hopelessly optimistic. And what we're seeing now is there's always been a problem with American foreign policy. It's never been, it's never been joined up. It's a result of different lobbies, of forces within there. It's almost Byzantine in the way that you know, the State Department, the Pentagon, the military industrial contractors, the politicians representing the lobbies, where they kick things around until it comes. And then, you know, in the past, you had the State Department acting like a gyroscope and saying, well, yes, you might want that, but international law says no. Jerusalem is not Israel's capital. Or international law says no, Western Sahara is not part of Morocco, no matter what the President of the United States says. But that type of moderating influence is almost gone, because one of the things that Trump and the ideologues did was to wage a complete war against the State Department and the more rational aspects of the American foreign policy establishment. So in that sense, what Joe Biden has done is entirely rational. He said, we can't win in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not one of our essential, it's not one of our essential fields of operation for the United States. The United States interests are not inextricably bound up there. Prestige might be, but we can live with their prestige. We're still the biggest military in the world. And then, you know, the old story about sticks and stones may break my bones, but the names will not be okay. I'm not the big superpower. Try anything on me and see what I do. It's a rational position that Biden's taken, but it is symbolic of American decline and the decline of their decision-making apparatus, that universally the political, military, and intelligence people let Biden down so thoroughly that he did not know that the Taliban had basically entered into an agreement and they bought the Afghan army wholesale on the ground, unit by unit.
You talked about that it's the logical thing to do, the rational thing to do. I think probably the question, though, for the American people and much of the world would be the way that they did what they did and why that they leave in the way that they did and cause such chaos. And what does that do to the American psyche itself? Because the American people, first of all, don't like to believe that they've been beaten, that they've lost the war, number one. And second of all, they don't like to hear that some have been left behind and basically American troops are running out of Afghanistan. I mean, what has that done in general for the American psyche inside of the country?
The American psyche, as far as I can see, is completely unflappable. Really, they really don't care. Afghanistan is a faraway country with a strange-sounding name, and most Americans are just happy to get out of there. Some of them might see it as a blot on their escutcheon, but, you know, another way of looking at it, if you're being rational, bearing in mind that it was a completely unprecedented collapse, that was the real failure, the fact that that wasn't anticipated. The U.S. showed its power. It got out over 100,000 people in a very short time from allegedly a hostile territory with very few casualties and very few left behind. It's shameful, but actually that shame is mostly brought on by the Trump people who brought about the debacle to begin with, who are picking on Biden for partisan points. I'm not a fan of Biden, but this was one of the more rational things, and a lot of what he's been accused of goes squarely back to Donald Trump and the Republicans who started this thing. Now, okay. Biden was one of the cheerleaders for those foreign adventures as part of the sort of neocon conspiracy to defend Israel. But on this particular aspect, he was clear-sighted. We couldn't win enough, and we have to get out.
Elijah, your assessment of it all, and what do you see as the main causes of the U.S.'s deterioration?
I think there are many points here. It is not only the rush that the U.S. left Afghanistan. It is only also the behavior toward the allies. I mean, here Europe is under shock to see how the U.S. withdrew without even consulting Europe, and the way they withdrew without talking to the allies. And this is why we're here today to talk about the necessity to form a European army, which is very early, and I don't know where this is going to lead us. However, the reason why the U.S. felt in such a hurry to leave is because they had the wrong information, the wrong assessment of the army that they have trained, and they had a very high expectation.
How does that happen? Sorry to jump in here, Elijah. I mean, how does that happen? You say wrong assessment. 20 years 20 years on the ground, 20 years American troops working or being side by side with Afghan troops, obviously evaluating the situation. How do you get it so wrong after 20 years?
Because the Americans make mistakes after mistakes. This is not the first time. And when because they lack also the understanding of the culture, they made this mistake in Iraq severely, and they did it again in Afghanistan when they expected to see the Afghan army engage in a civil war against other Afghani while they are negotiating with them in Qatar and delivering the country back to the Taliban. And they expect the army to fight and give them just 6 months' time so they can pull out all the Americans and the Afghan collaborators. And they say, done, we are out, and now you can continue fighting until you kill each other, and Taliban will again overwhelm all the army that we've trained for 20 years. This is a real failure that we've seen also in Iraq in 2014, where they've trained the army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army crumbled in just 3 days in Mosul and in the north of Iraq. It is not only the failure of the intelligence services, it is not the lack of visibility and right assessment, it is not only the non-understanding of the and the local culture, it is just everything was going wrong. And because they think, the American think, we can import our culture anywhere we go, this is fundamentally wrong. They are never going to change the culture of a country, and it's never going to be customized to the Americans' culture and mentality. Nobody asked the Americans to come, and nobody asked, and they were forced to leave. After 20 years, they removed the Taliban in 2001 to give back the power in 2021 again to the Taliban.
Ian, even during a pandemic and health crisis, we have seen anything but solidarity in the way the American society has approached the issue. I mean, do you attribute this to a major mistrust by many of their leadership overall? And how does this affect the whole, the schism that has come about inside of the country? Is there overall mistrust for the leadership?
Well, I mean, you quoted at the beginning Francis Fukuyama, who wrote just before the end of the Cold War about after the end of the Cold War about the end of history, when in fact history had just restarted where it was left off in 1914. And to give him his due, Francis Fukuyama has admitted he was wrong about that thesis. And here, in effect, we're seeing the American Civil War still continuing after 160 years. I mean, the issues of race and privilege and culture are still hugely predominant here. I mean, we have Texas just passed an act which basically encourages vigilantism against women. We have almost post-Reconstruction states legislatures all over the South enacting legislation that makes it almost impossible for minorities and poor people to vote. And this is being done without interference on the federal level. We have a party which tried to stage a coup against its own government on January the 6th. We have a failed president who's proclaiming he's still the one. These are not the hallmarks of a sophisticated and balanced society. This is the society that's riven down the middle, and there are people who hate each other. You know, 30-40% of Americans don't believe you can be patriotic and a Democrat. They certainly don't believe you can be patriotic and a socialist. They have their own very peculiar definitions, and it's a society that's based on exclusion and hatred on their part. They're actually dying in thousands because they think that wearing masks is a form of subservience to socialism, to galloping communism. They're refusing vaccinations in the middle of a death-dealing plague. I mean, you know, it's difficult. The German word is schadenfreude, take pleasure at the misfortunes and others. But I can't help grinning every time I see the latest right-wing radio commentator dying of COVID after he's run his latest rampage about vaccination and masks. They're still dying, though. Until they hit the hospital bed and the tubes are rammed down their throats, what's coming the other way out of their throats are invocations to resist the government, resist masks, watch out for those Democrats, they're coming after your daughters and everything else. It really is a very sick society, and there's it goes back to the Civil War, but it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who saw those fissures were still there and started the process of enlarging the fissures, of basically playing the race card, which they've done year after year, and now it's an even bigger, it's a culture card, where, you know, any minorities are the target for vilification and witch hunts. It's not a stable society. And what's worse is that the people who actually make the decisions in Washington, the last 20 years of hollowing out by the Republicans, they've taken away, for years, if you spoke Arabic in the State Department, you were denied promotion. And you were talking about how could they? When the Shah was driven out of Tehran, U.S. mission people were still sending back rosy reports because none of them read Farsi. They didn't see all the graffiti on the street walls saying death to the Shah on their way in. They probably thought it was an advert for Coca-Cola. They did not know what was happening in the country they were stationed in because of their cultural arrogance.
Well, what about that, Elijah? I mean, now when we look at the situation and the overall situation of the U.S., many will say that it's a dying empire. It's under lots of pressure right now as far as its so-called prestige in the world. Other analysts will say it's some of the most dangerous times when an empire feel pressured. Your take on where this can go with the United States basically waning, as Ian said at the beginning, it may be waning, but it still has a lot of power. Your assessment of it at this point in time?
I think we are in a very dangerous situation today. The danger comes from an administration that wants to show that it has not been defeated and it still had the power to do something. And that will take us to the possibility of American just supporting another war somewhere or a battle between in West Asia. Secondly, the Americans, if they are smart enough to understand that they cannot sustain a presence in country where there is no interest to stay, like, for example, in northeast Syria, that is even exactly the same as Afghanistan, is so far, there is no interest for the Americans to stay there. It's staying in Iraq when the population, half of the population at least, is against them and carrying attack. So if they reach this realization that it is time to stop being involved in country that are far, there is no interest for the American, and they have to withdraw, then the world will be really in a better shape.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see really an American administration committing one mistake after another.